Fangloy, ikaw na katulor ali fataga. Fangloy, ikaw na katulor ali fataga. Fangloy, ikaw na katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to this, the 51st of the Cthulhu podcasts. We'll be opening with the next part of Teddy Roosevelt's book Through the Brazilian Wilderness, then we'll have a musical interlude, which will be followed by a story by Robert E. Howard. Let's get started. Through the Brazilian Wilderness, Part 18. Soon afterward, we reached one of the outstations of the huge ranch we were about to visit, and hauled up alongside the bank for the night. There was a landing place, and sheds and corrals. Several of the peons, or gauchos, had come to meet us. After dark they kindled fires, and sat beside them singing songs in a strange minor key, and strumming guitars. The red firelight flickered over the wild figures as they squatted away from the blaze, where the light and the shadow met. It was still hot, and there were mosquitoes, of course, and other insects of all kinds swarmed round every light, but the steamboat was comfortable, and we passed a pleasant night. At sunrise we were off for the Fazenda, the ranch of M. D. Barros. The baggage went in an ox cart, which had to make two trips, so that all of my belongings reached the ranch a day later than I did. We rode small, tough ranch horses. The distance was some 20 miles. The whole country was marsh, varied by stretches of higher ground, and although these stretches rose only 3 or 4 feet above the marsh, they were covered with thick jungle, largely palmetto scrub, or else with open palm forest. For 3 or 4 miles we splashed through the marsh, now and then crossing boggy pools where the little horses laboured hard not to mire down. Our dusky guide was clad in a shirt, trousers, and fringed leather apron, and wore spurs on his bare feet. He had a rope for a bridle, and 2 or 3 toes of each foot were thrust into little iron stirrups. The pools in the marsh were drying. They were filled with fish, most of them dead or dying, and the birds gathered to the banquet. The most notable dinner guests were the great jabiro storks. The stately creatures dotted the marsh. But ibis and herons abounded. The former uttered queer, querulous cries when they discovered our presence. The spurred lapwings were as noisy as they always are. The ibis and plover do not pay any heed to the fish, but the black carrion vultures feasted on them in the mud, and in the pools that were not dry, small alligators, the jacare tinga, were feasting also. In many places the stench from the dead fish was unpleasant. Then for miles we rode through a beautiful open forest of tall, slender caranda palms, with other trees scattered among them. Green parakeets with black heads chattered as they flew. Noisy green and red parrots climbed among the palms, and huge macaws, some entirely blue, others almost entirely red, screamed loudly as they perched in the trees or took wing at our approach. If one was wounded, its cries kept its companions circling around overhead. The naturalists found the bird fauna totally different from that which they had been collecting in the hill country near Corumba, 70 or 80 miles distant. And birds swarmed, both species and individuals. South America has the most extensive and most varied avifauna of all the continents. On the other hand, its mammalian fauna, although very interesting, is rather poor in number of species and individuals and in the size of the beasts. It possesses more mammals that are unique and distinctive in type than does any other continent save Australia, but there is nothing approaching the majesty, beauty, and swarming mass of the great mammalian life of Africa, and, in a less degree, of tropical Asia. Indeed, it does not even approach the similar mammalian life of North America and northern Eurasia, poor though this is compared with the seething vitality of tropical life in the Old World. During a geologically recent period, a period extending into that which saw man spread over the world in substantially the physical and cultural stage of the many existing savages, South America possessed a varied and striking fauna of enormous beasts, saber-toothed tigers, huge lions, mastodons, horses of many kinds, camel-like pachyderms, giant ground sloths, mylodons the size of rhinoceros, and many, many other strange and wonderful creatures. From some cause, concerning the nature of which we cannot at present even hazard a guess, this vast and giant fauna vanished completely. The tremendous catastrophe, the duration of which is unknown, not being consummated until within a few thousand or a few score of thousand years. When the white man reached South America, he found the same weak and impoverished mammalian fauna that exists practically unchanged today. Elsewhere, civilized man has been even more destructive than his very destructive uncivilized brothers of the magnificent mammalian life of the wilderness. For ages he has been rooting out the higher forms of beast life in Europe, Asia, and North Africa, and in our own day he has repeated the feat on a very large scale in the rest of Africa and in North America. But in South America, although he is in places responsible for the wanton slaughter of the most interesting and the largest or the most beautiful birds, his advent has meant a positive enrichment of the wild mammalian fauna. None of the native grass-eating mammals, the gramnivores, approach in size and beauty the herds of wild or half-wild cattle and horses, or so add to the interest of the landscape. There is every reason why the good people of South America should waken, as we of North America, very late in the day, are beginning to waken, and as the peoples of Northern Europe, not Southern Europe, have partially already awakened, to the duty of preserving from impoverishment and extinction the wildlife which is an asset of such interest and value in our several lands. But the case against civilized man in this matter is gruesomely heavy anyhow, when the plain truth is told, and it is harmed by exaggeration. After 5 or 6 hours travelling through this country of marsh and palm forest, we reached the ranch for which we were heading. In the neighbourhood stood giant fig trees, singly or in groups, with dense dark green foliage. Ponds overgrown with water plants lay about, wet meadow and drier pasture land, open or dotted with palms and varied with tree jungle, stretch for many miles on every hand. There are some 30,000 head of cattle on the ranch, besides herds of horses and droves of swine, and a few flocks of sheep and goats. The home buildings of the ranch stood in a quadrangle, surrounded by a fence or low stockade. One end of the quadrangle was formed by the ranch house itself, one story high, with whitewashed walls and red-tiled roof. Inside, the rooms were bare, with clean whitewashed walls and palm trunk rafters. There were solid wooden shutters on the unglazed windows. We slept in hammocks or on cots, and we feasted royally on delicious native Brazilian dishes. On another side of the quadrangle stood another long, low white building with a red-tiled roof. This held the kitchen and the living rooms of the upper-grade peons, the headman, the cook, and jaguar hunters with their families. Dark-skinned men, their wives showing varied strains of white, Indian, and Negro blood. The children tumbled merrily in the dust and were fondly tended by their mothers. Opposite the kitchen stood a row of buildings, some whitewashed daub and wattle, with tin roofs, others erect palm logs with palm leaf thatch. These were the saddle room, storehouse, chicken house, and stable. The chicken house was allotted to Kermit and Miller for the preparation of the specimens, and there they worked industriously. With a big skin, like that of the giant anteater, they had to squat on the ground, while the ducklings and wee chickens scuffled not only around the skin, but all over it, grabbing the shreds and scraps of meat and catching flies. The fourth end of the quadrangle was formed by a corral and a big wooden scaffolding on which hung hides and strips of drying meat. Extraordinary to relate, there were no mosquitoes at the ranch. Why? I cannot say, as they ought to swarm in these vast pantanals, or swamps. Therefore, in spite of the heat, it was very pleasant. Nearby stood other buildings, sheds and thatched huts of palm logs in which the ordinary peons lived, and big corrals. In the quadrangle were flamboyant trees with their masses of brilliant red flowers and delicately cut, vivid green foliage. Noisy oven birds haunted these trees. In a high palm in the garden, a family of green parakeets had taken up their abode and were preparing to build nests. They chattered incessantly, both when they flew and when they sat or crawled among the branches. Ibis and plover, crying and wailing, passed immediately overhead. Jacanas frequented the ponds nearby. The peons, with a familiarity which to us seems sacrilegious, but to them was entirely inoffensive and matter of course, called them the Jesus Christ birds, because they walked on the water. There was a wealth of strange bird life in the neighbourhood. There were large papyrus marshes, and papyrus not being a fifth, perhaps not a tenth as high, as in Africa. In these swamps were many blackbirds. Some uttered notes that reminded me of our own redwings. Others, with crimson heads and necks and thighs, fairly blazed. Often a dozen sat together on a swaying papyrus stem, which their weight bent over. There were all sorts of extraordinary birds' nests in the trees. There is still need for the work of the collector in South America, but I believe that already, so far as birds are concerned, there is infinitely more need for the work of the careful observer, who to the power of appreciation and observation adds the power of vivid, truthful, and interesting narration, which means, as scientists no less than historians should note, that training in the writing of good English is indispensable to any learned man who expects to make his learning count for what it ought to count in the effect on his fellow men. The outdoor naturalist, the faunal naturalist, who devotes himself primarily to the study and habits of the life histories of birds, beasts, and fish and reptiles, and who can portray truthfully and vividly what he has seen, could do work of more usefulness than any mere collector in this upper Paraguay country. The work of the collector is indispensable, but it is only a small part of the work that ought to be done. And after collecting has reached a certain point, the work of the field observer with the gift for recording what he has seen becomes of far more importance. Our musical interlude today is called Waiting for the Evening Mail. It's sung by Marion Harris. This track is from 1923. Now to the main story presentation. The story is called A Rattle of Bones and is by Robert E. Howard. It's a classic story, and it stars a classic pulp-era hero. Solomon Kane.
Landlord, ho! The shout broke the lowering silence and reverberated through the black forest with sinister echoing. This place hath a forbidding aspect, meseemeth. Two men stood in front of the forest tavern. The building was low, long, and rambling, built of heavy logs. Its small windows were heavily barred, and the door was closed. Above the door its sinister sign showed faintly, a cleft skull. This door swung slowly open, and a bearded face peered out. The owner of the face stepped back and motioned his guests to enter, with a grudging gesture, it seemed. A candle gleamed on a table. A flame smoldered in the fireplace.
"Your names?"
"Solomon Kane," said the taller man briefly.
"Gaston Larmont,"
the other spoke curtly.
"But what is that to you?"
"Strangers are few in the Black Forest," grunted the host. "Bandits many. Sit at yonder table, and I will bring food."
The two men sat down, with the bearing of men who have traveled far. One was a tall, gaunt man, clad in a featherless hat and somber black garments, which set off the dark pallor of his forbidding face. The other was of a different type entirely, bedecked with lace and plumes, although his finery was somewhat stained from travel. He was handsome in a bold way, and his restless eyes shifted from side to side, never still an instant. The host brought wine and food to the rough-hewn table, and then stood back in the shadows, like a somber image. His features, now receding into vagueness, now luridly etched in the firelight as it leapt and flickered, were masked in a beard which seemed almost animal-like in thickness. A great nose curved above this beard, and two small red eyes stared unblinkingly at his guests.
"Who are you?" suddenly asked the younger man. "I am the host of the Cleft Skull Tavern," sullenly replied the other.
His tone seemed to challenge his questioner to ask further.
"Do you have many guests?"
Larmont pursued.
"Few come twice," the host grunted.
Kane started and glanced up straight into those small red eyes, as if he sought for some hidden meaning in the host's words. The flaming eyes seemed to dilate, then dropped sullenly before the Englishman's cold stare.
"I'm for bed," said Kane abruptly, bringing his meal to a close. "I must take up my journey by daylight."
"And I," added the Frenchman. "Host, show us to our chambers."
Black shadows wavered on the wall as the two followed their silent host down a long, dark hall. The stocky, broad body of their guide seemed to grow and expand in the light of the small candle which he carried, throwing a long, grim shadow behind him. At a certain door he halted, indicating that they were to sleep there. They entered, the host lit a candle with the one he carried, then lurched back the way he had come. In the chamber the two men glanced at each other. The only furnishings of the room were a couple of bunks, a chair or two, and a heavy table.
"Let us see if there be any way to make fast the door," said Kane. "I like not the looks of mine host."
"There are racks on the door and jamb for a bar," said Gaston, "but no bar."
"We might break up the table and use its pieces for a bar," mused Kane.
"Mon Dieu," said Larmont, "you are timorous, monsieur."
Kane scowled.
"I like not being murdered in my sleep," he answered gruffly.
"My faith," the Frenchman laughed, "we are chance met. Until I overtook you on the forest road an hour before sunset, we had never seen each other."
"I have seen you somewhere before," answered Kane, "though I cannot now recall where. As for the other, I assume every man is an honest fellow, until he shows me he is a rogue. Moreover, I am a light sleeper, and slumber with a pistol at hand."
The Frenchman laughed. "I was wondering how monsieur could bring himself to sleep in the room with a stranger. Ha ha! All right, monsieur Englishman, let us go forth and take a bar from one of the other rooms."
Taking the candle with them, they went into the corridor. Utter silence reigned, and the small candle twinkled redly and evilly in the thick darkness.
"Mine host hath neither guests nor servants," muttered Solomon Kane. "A strange tavern. What is the name now? These German words come not easily to me. The Cleft Skull? A bloody name, i'faith."
They tried the rooms next to theirs, but no bar rewarded their search. At last they came to the last room at the end of the corridor. They entered. It was furnished like the rest, except that the door was provided with a small barred opening, and fastened from the outside with a heavy bolt, which was secured at one end to the door jamb. They raised the bolt and looked in.
"There should be an outer window, but there is not," muttered Kane. "Look!"
The floor was stained darkly. The walls and the one bunk were hacked in places, great splinters having been torn away.
"Men have died in here," said Kane somberly.
"Is yonder not a bar fixed in the wall?"
"Aye, but 'tis made fast," said the Frenchman, tugging at it.
A section of the wall swung back, and Gaston gave a quick exclamation. A small secret room was revealed, and the two men bent over the grisly thing that lay upon its floor.
"The skeleton of a man," said Gaston. "And behold, how his bony leg is shackled to the floor. He was imprisoned here and died."
"Nay," said Cain, "the skull is cleft. Methinks mine host had a grim reason for the name of his hellish tavern.
This man, like us, was no doubt a wanderer who fell into the fiend's hands."
"Likely," said Gaston, without interest. He was engaged in idly working the great iron ring from the skeleton's leg bones. Failing in this, he drew his sword, and with an exhibition of remarkable strength, cut the chain which joined the ring on the leg to a ring set deep in the log floor.
"Why should he shackle a skeleton to the floor?" mused the Frenchman.
"Mon bleu, 'tis a waste of good chain. Now, monsieur," he ironically addressed the white heap of bones, "I have freed you, and you may go where you like." "Have done," Kane's voice was deep. "No good will come of mocking the dead."
"The dead should defend themselves," laughed Laurent. "Somehow I will slay the man who kills me, though my corpse climb up 40 fathoms of ocean to do it."
Kane turned toward the outer door, closing the door of the secret room behind him. He liked not this talk which smacked of demonry and witchcraft, and he was in haste to face the host with the charge of his guilt. As he turned, with his back to the Frenchman, he felt the touch of cold steel against his neck and knew that a pistol muzzle was pressed close beneath the base of his brain.
"Move not, monsieur," the voice was low and silky. "Move not, or I will scatter your few brains over the room."
The Puritan, raging inwardly, stood with his hands in the air, while Armand slipped his pistols and sword from their sheaths.
"Now you can turn," said Gaston, stepping back.
Kane bent a grim eye on the dapper fellow, who stood bareheaded now, hat in one hand, the other hand leveling his long pistol.
"Gaston the Butcher," said the Englishman somberly. "Fool that I was to trust a Frenchman! You range far, murderer. I remember you now, with that cursed great hat off. I saw you in Calais some years agone." "Aye, and now you will see me never again. What was that?"
"Rats exploring yon skeleton," said Kane, watching the bandit like a hawk, waiting for a single slight wavering of that black gun muzzle. The sound was of the rattle of bones.
"Like enough," returned the other. "Now, Monsieur Kane, I know you carry considerable money on your person. I had thought to wait until you slept and then slay you, but the opportunity presented itself, and I took it. You trick easily."
"I had little thought that I should fear a man with whom I had broken bread," said Kane, a deep timbre of slow fury sounding in his voice. The bandit laughed cynically. His eyes narrowed as he began to back slowly toward the outer door. Kane's sinews tensed involuntarily. He gathered himself like a giant wolf about to launch himself in a death leap, but Gaston's hand was like a rock, and the pistol never trembled.
"We will have no death plunges after the shot," said Gaston. "Stand still, monsieur. I have seen men killed by dying men, and I wish to have distance enough between us to preclude that possibility. My faith, I will shoot, you will roar and charge, but you will die before you reach me with your bare hands. And mine host will have another skeleton in his secret niche. That is, if I do not kill him myself. The fool knows me not, nor I him. Moreover..."
The Frenchman was in the doorway now, sighting along the barrel. The candle, which had been stuck in a niche on the wall, shed a weird flickering light which did not extend past the doorway. And with the suddenness of death, from the darkness behind Gaston's back, a broad, vague form rose up, and a gleaming blade swept down. The Frenchman went to his knees like a butchered ox, his brain spilling from his cleft skull. Above him towered the figure of the host, a wild and terrible spectacle, still holding the hanger with which he had slain the bandit.
"Ho, ho!" he roared. "Back!"
Kane had leapt forward as Gaston fell, but the host thrust into his very face a long pistol which he held in his left hand. "Back!" he repeated in a tigerish roar, and Kane retreated from the menacing weapon and the insanity in the red eyes. The Englishman stood silent, his flesh crawling as he sensed a deeper and more hideous threat than the Frenchman had offered. There was something inhuman about this man, who now swayed to and fro like some great forest beast, while his mirthless laughter boomed out again.
"Gaston the Butcher!" he shouted, kicking the corpse at his feet.
"Ho, ho! My fine brigand will hunt no more! I had heard of this fool who roamed the Black Forest. He wished gold, and he found death. Now your gold shall be mine, and more than gold, vengeance!"
"I'm no foe of yours," Cain spoke calmly.
"All men are my foes. Look, the marks on my wrists. See, the marks on my ankles. And deep in my back, the kiss of the knout. And deep in my brain, the wounds of the years of the cold, silent cells where I lay as punishment for a crime I never committed."
The voice broke in a hideous, grotesque sob. Cain made no answer. This man was not the first he had seen whose brain had shattered amid the horrors of the terrible continental prisons.
"But I escaped," the scream rose triumphantly. "And here I make war on all men. What was that?"
Did Cain see a flash of fear in those hideous eyes?
"My sorcerer is rattling his bones," whispered the host, then laughed wildly. "Dying, he swore his very bones would weave a net of death for me. I shackled his corpse to the floor, and now, deep in the night, I hear his bare skeleton clash and rattle as he seeks to be free. And I laugh, ho, ho, how he yearns to rise and stalk like old King Death along these dark corridors when I sleep, to slay me in my bed."
Suddenly the insane eyes flared hideously.
"You were in that secret room, you and this dead fool. Did he talk to you?"
Cain shuddered in spite of himself. Was it insanity, or did he actually hear the faint rattle of bones, as if the skeleton had moved slightly? Cain shrugged his shoulders. Rats will even tug at dusty bones. The host was laughing again. He sidled around Cain, keeping the Englishman always covered, and with his free hand opened the door. All was darkness within, so that Cain could not even see the glimmer of the bones on the floor.
"All men are my foes," mumbled the host, in the incoherent manner of the insane. "Why should I spare any man? Who lifted a hand to my aid when I lay for years in the vile dungeons of Karlsruhe? And for a deed never proven? Something happened to my brain then. I became as a wolf, a brother to these of the Black Forest, to which I fled when I escaped. They have feasted, my brothers, on all who lay in my tavern, all except this one who now clashes his bones, this magician from Russia. Lest he come stalking back through the black shadows when night is over the world, and slay me, for who may slay the dead? I stripped his bones and shackled him. His sorcery was not powerful enough to save him from me, but all men know that a dead magician is more evil than a living one. Move not, Englishman. Your bones I shall leave in this secret room beside this one, too."
The maniac was standing partly in the doorway of the secret room now, his weapon still menacing Cain. Suddenly he seemed to topple backward and vanished in the darkness, and at the same instant a vagrant gust of wind swept down the outer corridor and slammed the door shut behind him. The candle on the wall flickered and went out. Cain's groping hands, sweeping over the floor, found a pistol, and he straightened, facing the door where the maniac had vanished. He stood in the utter darkness, his blood freezing, while a hideous muffled screaming came from the secret room, intermingled with the dry, grisly rattle of fleshless bones. Then silence fell. Cain found flint and steel and lighted the candle. Then, holding it in one hand and the pistol in the other, he opened the secret door. "Great God!" he muttered, as cold sweat formed on his body. "This thing is beyond all reason, yet with mine own eyes I see it. Two vows have here been kept, for Gaston the Butcher swore that even in death he would avenge his slaying, and his was the hand which set yon fleshless monster free. And he..." The host of the cleft skull lay lifeless on the floor of the secret room, his bestial face set in lines of terrible fear, and deep in his broken neck were sunk the bare finger bones of the sorcerer's skeleton.
That reading was done for us by Paul Siegel. Nice one, Paul. Well, that's it. Remember, everybody, I'm on the lookout for more stories, so if you've written a creepy horror story, send it in to me, and let's see if we can get it on the show. Opening music for this podcast is by Victor Valdez and comes from the Symbol Project. This file is released under an attribution share-alike license. Until next time. CthulhuPodcast.co.uk